Today is Wednesday, January 24th. We're going to work on wrapping up the endocrine system and starting blood typing today. As a reminder, exam number one has been moved to Wednesday, February 7th. That way it does not conflict with the lab exam scheduled on Monday, February the 5th. I'm going to start you from the beginning with glucocorticoids. They're on the top of page 13. And what gland makes our glucocorticoids? Adrenals. Good. And we were talking on Monday about the naming scheme here. What does the word corticoid tell us?
Steroid.
Good. It's a steroid hormone. And we also can use that as a clue to say, hey, this hormone is made by your adrenal cortex. So this is an unusual group of hormones. Most of our hormones in the body are protein-based, but these adrenal cortex hormones happen to be steroid-based. So how do these hormones talk to their target cells?
Straight on in,
right. And the receptor is found inside the cell. Yeah, so it's an intracellular receptor. So instead of talking about the glucocorticoids as the class of hormones, I'm going to instead talk about the specific examples. We're going to talk about cortisone and cortisol. And another clue there is own cortisone. That suffix, again, says this is a steroid hormone. So a lot of good built-in clues here. So what does cortisone or cortisol regulate for us? Glucose, good, blood sugar over the long term. So that's one major function of cortisone. What impact does cortisone have on inflammation? Good, yes, suppresses the immune system. So we were thinking on Monday about the four cardinal signs of inflammation. What were those? Redness, pain, swelling, and heat. So if you'd use something like hydrocortisone on an itchy bug bite, that can help suppress the immune response and help alleviate some of those symptoms. Now, thinking about this in terms of a medication, people who take corticosteroids, say, for a long-term period of time to reduce inflammation, what impact do you think that has on their immune system? Good. Weaken that immune system over time. Immune system can't function properly. So in terms of a long-term use of corticosteroids, what does this open the person up for? Yeah, open you up for disease and infection because your immune system is being suppressed. And what about your blood sugar levels?
High.
Yes, so you may experience high blood sugar levels. We call that hyperglycemia, and we diagnose it as diabetes mellitus. So we can end up looking at diabetes being formed from someone who takes long-term corticosteroids. We do know that stress can turn on this hormone. Stress can activate corticotropic releasing hormone. Where is CRH made? Hypothalamus, good. What does CRH target? Anterior pituitary. So if you're hypersecreting, say, CRH due to stress, you will now produce excess ACTH. What does ACTH target? Adrenal glands, good. And of course, those adrenals can produce excess cortisol in the case of stress. So you've probably heard the situation of, you know, if you're stressed out, people develop high blood pressure and they gain weight. Well, this is part of that weight gain loop that we can get into. So I'd like to talk to you about the role of sugar metabolism. It's called gluconeogenesis, and it's assisted by cortisol. We did this on Monday. Just want to go back and repeat this one more time today. And this will help us kind of tie in those pancreatic hormones to our discussion. So blood sugar levels for glucose should remain within a narrow range. Blood glucose levels are monitored by the pancreas, and of course the pancreas acts as a control center. That's unusual, because normally when you hear about negative feedback loops, what do you normally assign as a control center?
Brain.
Yeah. So this is an unusual situation. We've actually got the pancreas behaving as a control center for these blood glucose levels. Normally, blood glucose at fasting should be around 70 to 120 units per deciliter of blood. So we'll just kind of tuck that in our back of our minds. Krispy Kreme donuts, right? Full of sugar, give you a sugar rush. So on Monday morning, you go and you have yourself some Krispy Kreme donuts, as many as you can eat, and your blood sugar is pumped up way above and beyond that 120 top end of your range there. Now, over the short term period of time, what hormone lowers your blood sugar levels?
Insulin.
Good. Insulin's going to lower those blood sugar levels. Insulin actually does two things. It takes glucose into your cells and it gives you that sugar high, that, you know, feeling of the incredible Hulk that you can climb a mountain. So you have a sugar rush after you've had a sugary meal. That's one thing insulin does with the sugar. Another thing insulin does is it takes these excess glucose molecules, helps them join together and form a more complex carb called glycogen. All right, so where do we store glycogen? Liver, good, and muscles. Yep, so we store that glucose as glycogen. Glycogen is stored for around 2 to 3 days. After that time period, your body says, all right, I'm tired of holding this for you. You know, your body says, I thought you'd come back and get this glycogen from me, but since you haven't, I will store it as fat.
Yep.
So those adipose tissue locations under our skin are a great place to store this excess energy. And so we turn it into fat, and that's where it can stay. So let's talk about using sugar. We basically want to use glucose as our body's preferred fuel for making ATP. So, you know, if you get up one morning and you've got a crazy busy morning and you don't have a chance to eat or drink anything, your body's going to burn through your available glucose supplies first. It's easy to tap into that glucose is in your bloodstream, so we burn through that glucose first. After we burn through that available glucose to make ATP, we now have to go to our first backup plan, and that is glycogen. So we will then tap into our glycogen supplies, and then we'll turn it into glucose by breaking it down. So we go to our liver and our muscles, and we say, okay, glycogen, time to be broken up, and then we use it as glucose. What hormone helps us break down glycogen into glucose? It's actually something, if you've looked ahead into the pancreas, it works against insulin. It is called glucagon. Yeah, it's called glucagon. Okay, so glucagon actually raises blood sugar. And it does so specifically by targeting your liver and your muscles to help break down glycogen and turn it into glucose. Crazy busy morning where you don't have an opportunity to eat, and you're very busy, and you're very physically active, and you're running around, and you're burning through your glucose supplies. Take care of them first. Then you tap into your glycogen supplies, and you start burning off the glycogen that's stored in your liver and your muscles. Now, if you're very, very physically active and you're busy, you can burn through that glycogen, and you can now tap into your fat supplies that's found underneath your skin. So we then start breaking that fat down into glycogen and then back into glucose. Now, this is where cortisol comes into play. So cortisol performs a job called gluconeogenesis, and it breaks down that fat ultimately into some usable glucose. I'm going to use a different color here. I know we got a little bit of space to work with. I'm going to use a dotted line to represent that that's cortisol that helps us break down fat into glucose. So cortisol is going to actually do the same job in terms of raising your blood sugar as glucagon. So they, in effect, work as synergists here to help raise your blood glucose levels. All right, I'm just going to put a note here that this process is called gluconeogenesis. So if you break the word gluconeogenesis down, gluco as a prefix means what?
Sugar.
It's sugar, good. And neo is really important because it's new. And genesis is to create or make, good. So the catch here is you're talking about getting sugar from a new source. Normally when you talk about sugar, you don't include fat in your discussion. You know, in terms of the way organic compounds are built, but in the way that we can actually break down fat and create sugar, it's actually a new source of sugar for us. So it's not a clean way to make glucose or energy, but nonetheless, if you've got to have glucose to make ATP, you tap into whatever you can, fats and even proteins included. Okay, so you know we've talked about how excess cortisol can raise your blood sugar. So let's talk about that using this diagram. If you have excess cortisol, what does that extra cortisol do to your fat supplies?
It's going to deplete it.
It's going to deplete it, so you'll lose weight. Okay, sounds like a good deal. And what does that extra fat that we're burning off turn into?
It turns back into glucose.
Back into glucose, good. Now, here's the catch. If you're overactive in terms of getting cortisol to work against, you know, break down those fat molecules, then you may be producing a lot of sugar. And if you're very physically active, fantastic, you'll burn the sugar off. Everything is okay. However, if you're stressed out and you're not physically active enough, cortisol may break down a bunch of fat, giving you a bunch of sugar. And so in turn, if you don't burn off that sugar, what happens to it?
It
goes right back to fat, right. And where this can become a really tricky mess is when you also break down proteins. Because if your body takes lean, healthy muscle tissue and breaks it down into sugar, make you weaker, exactly. And if you don't burn off that sugar, you then store your muscle tissue back as fat. Yeah, so that's how the weight gain can come. So it's an unfortunate side effect of the way cortisol tends to work. So I had a student years ago, telling me I'm time to move on, right? Had a student years ago who had a disorder related to cortisol, and what happened to her was she was gaining weight even though she was eating very little. And so, you know, she noticed that she was starting to get a pot belly, and she called her beer belly, but jokingly she said she didn't drink any alcohol, so she wondered why she was gaining weight like that. So she put herself on a restrictive diet of eating tuna fish and crackers for 3 months. And after those 3 months, she still hadn't lost weight. She was actually continuing to gain weight. So she was, you know, very regimented, making sure that she had a very restrictive calorie intake. So she eventually went to her doctor, got tested, and guess what hormone she was making too much of?
Cortisol.
Cortisol, yeah. So they said, okay, hey, here's what's happening. You're breaking down your muscle tissue and your fat supplies. You're turning it into
sugar.
And since you're not burning it off, it's getting restored back as fat.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly, right. So if she was insanely physically active, she might have burned it off, but unfortunately it didn't work that way for her. So she actually had a disorder that we'll talk about today. It's called Cushing syndrome, and they actually did surgery to take out her pituitary gland. So thinking big picture, why do you think they take out the pituitary for somebody who has an adrenal gland issue? Right, you interrupt this chain of command, exactly. So in her case, she didn't have adrenal tumors. She had a pituitary tumor. And if you take out that anterior pituitary, you interrupt the communication from the hypothalamus to the pituitary, ultimately to the adrenal gland. So for her, that seemed to be the trick in working for her. So we'll come back and talk about her case in a little bit when we target the Cushing syndrome in the bottom of this page. All right, so how about questions on cortisol? All right, so let's talk about gonadocorticoids or sex hormones. They're about midway down page 13. All right, so corticoid, what type of hormone is this?
Sex hormone.
Sex hormone, good. What type or what body parts do these hormones regulate? Gonads, right? Okay, so say for females, ovaries, for males, testes. And ultimately what we're doing here is we're making some sex hormones. We actually make very small amounts of sex hormones at our adrenal glands. We make little amounts of hormones called androgens. Andro means male, and these male hormones are mostly testosterone, although there is some small amount of estrogen produced in those adrenals as well. We believe that these hormones are regulated by CRH. Where is CRH produced? Good. What does CRH target? Good. And of course, ACTH is then made. And what does it target? Adrenal glands. Good. Okay. So they don't really understand why everybody makes a little bit of both sex hormones. But in fact, males make a little tiny bit of estrogen in their adrenals. And females make small amounts of testosterone in their adrenals. So, you know, everybody makes both sex hormones in their adrenal glands. In fact, they think that little boys and little girls that have not yet gone through puberty start developing, you know, masculine features or feminine features thanks to the small amounts of hormones coming from those adrenal glands. After menopause for females, if women have, say, a little bit too much testosterone, or if their cells are sensitive to it, then females can actually start developing masculinizing effects after menopause. So, you know, later in life, we may see some changes occurring there. All right, so let's go ahead and move forward into our adrenal gland disorders. These are in the bottom of your page. All right, the first one there is called Addison's disease. Got a blank to fill in. The cause is hyposecretion. Okay, the blank there is hyposecretion of cortisol and or aldosterone. So what does hyposecretion mean?
Low,
good, okay. Craving for dirt. So let's talk about cortisol first of all. If you have low levels of cortisol, how does that impact your blood sugar?
You won't be able to get enough of it when you need it.
Right, you may not have enough blood sugar. Your blood sugar may be low. So that can account for things like the fatigue and the muscle weakness here, and certainly the weight loss. Let's talk about aldosterone. If you have low levels of aldosterone, how does that impact your blood pressure? Yeah, there you go. So low blood pressure, that's looking at aldosterone insufficiency. And Which hormone would you attribute to salt cravings? Does that look like a cortisol issue, or does that look like an aldosterone issue? Yeah, it looks like an aldosterone issue. So, you know, oftentimes when women are pregnant, they'll crave crazy things. You know, we hear about pickles and ice cream all the time, right? But, you know, in fact, pregnant women may crave other things like dirt, baking soda, cornstarch, and you wonder why they crave those particular things, and it may in fact be due to pica, where they have low levels of sodium or salts in their bloodstream. So pregnancy is one time where we tend to see pica pop up, and it doesn't have to necessarily be a pregnant woman. It can be anybody with Addison's disease may crave some of these, what we consider to be non-food items. I had a student a few years ago, and she said she kept a box of baking soda at work behind her desk, and every day she consumed most of a box of baking soda. Wow, that's a lot of baking soda.
So pica is another thing, salt cravings?
Salt cravings, yeah. So not to be confused with cravings for ice. If you know anybody that likes to chew on ice, that's a sign for anemia. But if you're craving salt, things like, you know, baking soda, dirt, chalk, all sorts of things that normally we wouldn't eat, then that may point to an Addison's disease issue. If you guys have seen that show on TLC, The Strange Addictions, you know, they always have people in there that want to eat strange stuff, and it seems like they always want to get those people into therapy, and I want to say, no, test them, see if they've got Addison's disease, because they've got people in there eating, you know, detergent and all sorts of other things, and they never once mentioned testing them for this disorder. But, you know, it'd be interesting to see how many of them actually have an Addison's issue going on. So Addison's disease can also cause bronzing of the skin or skin darkening, and that doesn't seem like it has anything to do with cortisol or aldosterone. In fact, it has something to do with a different hormone that we don't discuss. It's called melanocyte-stimulating hormone. So if you turn on MSH, what does melanocyte-stimulating hormone actually start your skin producing? Melanin, yeah. And so what happens to you?
You start getting darker skin.
You start getting darker skin, yeah, even if you're not exposed to sunlight. So they think that JFK had Addison's disease back in the 1960s. Color television was fairly new. Not many people had it. But those who did saw that he was tanned and thought, oh, he must be outside. And he, in fact, was an avid outdoorsman. But they think that the bronzing of his skin was due to Addison's disease. In fact, his inner circle was scared he would die in office due to Addison's, but as you probably know, he was assassinated, so we never know how that story would have ended. This can be symptomatic of Addison's disease. Nobody goes outside to sun their gums, right? Okay, so if you've got melanin being deposited in your gums, then it's one of two things likely. What else could this be? What kind of cancer of the melanocytes could cause that? Melanoma, yeah. There are cases of melanoma where people have darkening of the gums, and these splotchy looking areas of pigmentation can also show up with Addison's disease. So it's not something you would normally expect to be with an adrenal gland disorder, but Addison's ties in that loop of, you know, melanocyte-stimulating hormone. So now everybody's going to go home and check their gums, right? Okay, so that's Addison's disease. Any questions on that one? So Addison's is a hyposecretion problem, too little cortisol, too little aldosterone. Cushing's, by contrast, is a hypersecretion problem. That's your blank. Hypersecretion of cortisol. I know we talk about a lot of disorders in here. We've talked about Graves' disease and Addison's and now Cushing's. One way to keep this one straight is the fact that it makes your body cushiony or fat. So Cushing's disease is based on excess cortisol, so it promotes weight gain and obesity. Right, so why does cortisol in excess make a person gain weight? What is it breaking down?
It's breaking down the sugar so fast where they can't burn it off, so they're off and it's turning back into fat.
Good, yes. Yeah, so they're producing sugar so fast from fats and proteins. If they don't burn off that sugar quickly enough, then it turns right back and is stored as fat. And even lean, healthy muscle tissue can be turned into sugar and then back into fat. So these people gain weight. And the story I was telling you about earlier, the student that I had years ago, she had Cushing's. She ended up having a pituitary tumor. But people with this disorder may also experience adrenal gland tumors. So they have to check both the pituitary and the adrenals to see if there's anything going on there. So we can explain obesity and the weight gain around the face. We call it moon face. We can explain those with excess cortisol. We can also explain the stretch marks in a thin skin that come from very fast growth and very fast weight gain. The buffalo hump on the back of the neck actually comes from brown fat storage. You know, when we talked about adipose tissue in Bio-210, we oftentimes don't explain that there are two types of fat. There's white fat, which is on most of your body, and then there's brown fat back here between your shoulder blades. Let me fast forward real quick. Notice this woman's back here, that little bit of fat deposited there. That's called a buffalo hump, and that comes from having excess brown fat stored there. Now, when we were babies, you know, of course, assuming that we were going to be breast milk fed, you might have been waiting 2 or 3 days or longer for mom's breast milk to come in. And so considering that that might have been the life we lead, we would have to rely on our brown fat to help us exist. So if you do have excess fat, it can be stored between the shoulder blades back here. Let's go back to our list of symptoms. Irritability, anxiety, and depression can also come from a tie-in of other hormones. We may experience, you know, problems with excess epinephrine. The student that I told you about that ate the tuna fish and crackers for 3 months, she had a case of, you know, severe depression, very anxious. She was an artist. She liked to do, you know, art in her part-time and her free time. And she said she was so ranked up with anxiety that she couldn't even relax enough to do her artwork. So after her surgery and they removed her pituitary gland, then she said she was able to calm back down because all that excess epinephrine was gone from her system. Again, we see bronzing of the skin, and you can even see excess hair growth in females or in males. We call that hirsutism, and that comes from excess sex hormones produced by the adrenal glands. So you can experience, you know, Cushing's disease from medications. So if you stay on a long-term course of, say, Dexpack, prednisone, something of that sort, we may experience Cushing's syndrome. So if you take, say, a long-term course of prednisone, what happens to your blood sugar? Goes up, yeah. What happens to your immune system? Goes down, yes. Yeah, so you suppress that immune response. And in addition to all of that, you can experience these symptoms listed here. So endogenous Cushing's is caused by a tumor somewhere, most likely in the pituitary gland or the adrenal glands. So they have to check both locations, and then they can remove the tumor if it's hypersecreting hormones. So the student that I had years ago with Cushing's disease, for her, they went up through her nose, broke a bone, went back into her brain, very carefully wedged between her optic nerves, and then right there where the nerves cross at the optic chiasma, they find the pituitary gland, and they snip it, and they pull it out back through her nose. So, you know, that's the going rate for how they do brain surgery and taking out that pituitary gland. Little boy before, you know, had surgery after, you know, notice the huge amount of weight loss he had in the face. Little girl with Cushing's. These are the stretch marks that come from quick growth and weight gain. Stretch marks are permanent, so, you know, they may fade in appearance, but they're always yours to keep. They're a souvenir of what you've been through in life's trials and tribulations. And, of course, you know, they can be rather shiny and very hard to disguise, like you can see in these pictures here. So that is drug-induced Cushing syndrome. That's an amazing amount of weight gain. We talked about the buffalo hump. Another man with Cushing's before and after his surgery. All right, and so that now takes us to our third and final disorder, and that one's going to be masculinization of women. So So where is testosterone made in a female? Adrenal glands, right. So females produce a small amount of testosterone all the time. Usually she produces enough estrogen to mask the effects of that testosterone. It is a very small amount to begin with. If a female hypersecretes testosterone, then she can experience masculinizing effects. Like what?
Hair on her face.
Hair on her face, right. What else?
A deeper voice.
A deeper voice, right. Okay, so, you know, back in the 1800s when the circus became very popular, the old, you know, thing was, hey, here's the bearded lady. Some of these women had quite full beards, as you can see in these pictures here. It doesn't have to be quite that dramatic. It could be something like, a little more like a peach fuzz growth, like you see in this picture. But nonetheless, you know, these are all signs that point toward the adrenal glands hypersecreting testosterone in a female. This three-year-old actually is going through what's called precocious puberty. And so most three-year-olds shouldn't be heading through puberty and having pubic hair and breast development or anything else of that sort at this age. So what do you think are some of the problems of having a three-year-old go through puberty? Especially a little girl, what could happen to her? Yeah, her cycle could come early, right? So she may start menstruating thanks to excess hormone production at age three. Nowadays, if they can catch this and diagnose it, they will stop it. They will put you in what's called like a suspended animation, and they will, you know, inhibit more hormones from being produced until you reach a more appropriate age for puberty. And then at that point, they let it rip. They stop those hormones from being suppressed, and then they let the puberty progress as it would. So besides going through a menstrual cycle at this age, what else do sex hormones do to our bodies? What do sex hormones do to epiphyseal plates? Yep, causes them to come line. So it may give you one last big growth spurt, and that's it. And then, of course, you're right, you turn it into a line so the growth can be stunted. So yeah, nowadays we do have a way to manipulate the hormones and stop this from progressing. All right, so that should take care of page 13. How about questions on that page? Let's talk about the medulla on page 14. This is still part of the adrenal gland. What type of tissue makes up the adrenal medulla? Endocrine
nervous
tissue or?
Nervous
tissue. Yeah, nervous tissue, good. All right, so thinking back, you may recall having learned about the nervous systems in Bio-210, and you may recall that there is a system called the autonomic nervous system. What kinds of events are controlled by that system?
Involuntary.
Good, involuntary, right. There were two branches of the autonomic nervous system. There was a parasympathetic branch and a sympathetic branch. Okay, so hopefully this is coming back somewhere in your back of your mind. And of course, the sympathetic nervous system is the one that involves a fight or flight response. What are the two hormones released through that fight or flight response?
Epinephrine.
Good, good. So we call them epinephrine. You can call it epi, you're right, for short. Its alternate name is adrenaline. And we also have norepinephrine. You can call it norepi or NE for short. And its alternate name is noradrenaline. These two are synergist, meaning what?
They work together.
Good. They are a tag team. You know, you've got about 80% of the hormones produced are epinephrine. About 20% being produced is norepinephrine. But they do produce the same kinds of responses like these. We do see that epinephrine and norepinephrine increase blood glucose levels. Hey, if you're keeping track, that's really adding to the list, isn't it? So we've got glucagon raises blood glucose. What else? Cortisol. Okay, now you've got epinephrine and norepinephrine. That gives us four so far that raise blood sugar and only one that lowers blood sugar. Which one is that? Insulin, yeah. So, You know, there's certainly a big fight there to increase that blood sugar. Epinephrine and norepinephrine also increase the heart rate and blood pressure during the fight or flight response. They increase the diameter of your bronchial passageway so you can breathe in more oxygen during fight or flight. And then we suppress our abdominopelvic activity. We decrease digestion and urination activities when we're experiencing an increase in epinephrine and norepinephrine. So I'm hoping this is just a good review for you. Let me go back one more time and repeat the difference between a neurotransmitter and a hormone. We know that epinephrine and norepinephrine can work as both neurotransmitters and as hormones. For them to be considered hormones, where must they be traveling? In the blood. Yeah, in the bloodstream, right. And so they're not fast if they're in the bloodstream, but if they're traveling from one cell, like a neuron, to the next cell, you're right. It's like instantaneous. Good. So that's where your speed comes from, is as neurotransmitters. All right. So that should do it for the adrenal glands. How about questions on that setup? Cortex, medulla, any of those hormones? Well, we've actually done most of the pancreas. We've already talked about the two hormones made there, so we'll just go back and review this one now. It's over on page 15. So where is the pancreas located? Kind of behind the stomach, behind the liver?
Yeah.
So if you were to lift up your stomach and move it out of the way, hidden behind, kind of wedged up in your small intestine, is the pancreas. It kind of is shaped like a triangular tongue, and you'll notice that it has some ductwork laying on top of it there. The pancreas actually has two jobs. It serves a role as a digestive organ, and it also plays a role as an endocrine organ. So we're going to ignore for right now that digestive role and these ducts that are found on top here. The pancreas actually works as an exocrine gland for the digestive system, so we're going to put that aside until we get to the digestive system. For right now, we're going to talk about a specific set of cells embedded within the pancreatic tissue, and those cells are set up like little pockets. You can see some of them here and there. These little pockets of cells are called islet cells. And so these islet cells produce two types of hormones. They're both going to regulate blood sugar, and they're called insulin and glucagon. Now, there's a specific cell that produces each hormone. Which specific islet cell produces insulin?
The beta
cells, right. And the islet cell that produces glucagon is called an alpha cell. Good. So, you know, I don't know how you want to keep these straight, but I keep that the A in alpha reminds me of the A in glucagon. And that's the way I kind of keep those two straight. So you may want to use some kind of trick like that to keep which set of cells produces which hormones straight. What does it mean that these hormones operate under humoral control?
Blood.
Yes. So blood glucose level, of course, is going to be what stimulates that pancreas to produce these hormones. And they are antagonists, meaning that they do what? Yeah, they work against each other. Good. So you'll notice that insulin is the one to lower blood glucose. We've talked about its story so far. Not only does it transport glucose into our cells so that we can make ATP, it also can store glucose where? Yeah, liver and muscles. Good. So how do you store extra glucose as glycogen? Right. So insulin can store excess glucose as glycogen. And if you need to raise the blood sugar levels, which hormone will do that for us, coming from the pancreas? Glucagon, right. So it's a lot of words here to keep straight. Glucagon helps us break down glycogen into glucose. That's a tongue twister, right? Okay, so glucagon helps break down glycogen glucagon helps break down glycogen into glucose. Glucagon helps break down glycogen into glucose. Let me repeat, we talked about control centers and negative feedback loops, and this is definitely a negative feedback loop that is controlled by insulin and glucagon. But you know, normally when we talk about control centers, we always include the brain as the control center. But not here, in terms of pancreatic regulation of blood glucose levels, it's the pancreas that happens to be the control center. So I make that point because we're going to talk about diabetes in just a moment. And diabetes is based on having the control center, the pancreas, fail to regulate the blood glucose levels. All right, so when a person develops diabetes mellitus, it is in fact those beta cells of the pancreas that fail to produce enough insulin. If you have type 1 diabetes, you don't produce any insulin at all. If you have type 2, you may in fact produce a little bit of insulin. All right, so let's talk about the symptoms of diabetes, no matter which form you may have. There's a blank there on your worksheet to fill in the three cardinal signs, and they are polys, polyuria, polyphagia, and polydipsia. So which one of these symptoms is an excess of urination?
Polyuria.
Polyuria, good. What is polyphagia?
Eating.
Eating, right, so hungry, okay. And polydipsia is?
Excessive drinking.
Yeah, thirsty, good. So all of these symptoms can be explained by the fact that we are producing not enough insulin and we have excess blood glucose. Your kidneys are going to remove that glucose in the urine. And so if you're losing your sugar in the urine, you're going to be hungry to replace those lost calories. And that's where polyphagia comes into play. Then you look at things like polyuria and polydipsia. We've probably heard that water follows salt, right? Okay. Water can follow sugar as well. So if you're losing glucose in your urine, water can follow too. So what that ends up doing is causing polyuria and polydipsia. We're basically just peeing away the fluids and then we're drinking to replace those lost fluids. Let me emphasize a difference here. You know, we talked about diabetes insipidus back in an earlier portion of this chapter. What hormone is deficient when a person has insipidus? ADH, good. There's some similar symptoms here, right? Okay, if you've got diabetes insipidus, which two symptoms do you have in common with diabetes mellitus? Polyuria and polydipsia, right. So the people with diabetes insipidus and that have ADH insufficiency don't have any problems with blood sugar, nor do they have any trouble with hunger because the blood sugar is just not an issue for them. Okay. So let me repeat here, diabetes insipidus is totally different from diabetes mellitus that we're currently discussing. Insipidus comes from a lack of ADH. And these two types of diabetes have two symptoms in common, polyuria and polydipsia. When people's blood sugars are out of whack, we may see things like nausea and vomiting. We may also experience a fruity breath due to ketoacidosis. Well, if the pancreas is not regulating blood sugar correctly, then we also see an increase in cortisol, which can produce more blood sugar. So it just makes a bad problem even worse when we've got something like ketoacidosis. The fruity breath that comes from ketoacidosis is unmistakable. It smells kind of like a fruity alcohol odor, kind of like acetone used to remove fingernail polish mixed with fruit juice. So it's an unmistakable odor. Once you smell it on someone's breath, it's hard to forget what it smells like or mistake it for anything else. But that can be a sign that blood sugar is high. Likewise, diabetics that are hot and dry may have high blood sugar, and if they're cold and clammy, their blood sugar may be low. Long-term conditions we see here are complications like blindness, kidney disease, heart disease, high levels of triglycerides, and then we can see amputations of limbs coming from all the excess sugar in the tissue space. So what is the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes?
Type 2 is non-insulin dependent.
Good. Type 1 is insulin dependent. Good. So people are born with type 1 diabetes. It may not be diagnosed at birth. In fact, it may not be diagnosed until you're 10 or 15 years old. A lot of times the symptoms are not as recognizable as you might experience for someone who's older in life and can tell you more about what they're experiencing. So if diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, that person then is insulin dependent, maybe having to use an insulin pump. Some exciting stuff is on the horizon here, though, for diabetes. They are finding that they can insert stem cells into a person's pancreas with type 1 diabetes and actually get that person producing insulin once again. So there has been a case where they've done this. They've actually been able to eliminate type 1 diabetes in a young girl, and she's got beta cells that are actively producing insulin. So maybe in years to come, we will have a fix for this kind of disorder. Type 2 diabetes, when does this tend to arise? Adulthood, right. These kinds of patients may not be insulin dependent. If unregulated, they may in fact become insulin dependent, but it may be managed with diet and exercise and some medication. Gestational diabetes may form during, of course, pregnancy. They test for it around week 28 by having women drink a very sugary sweet drink. And then if they diagnose it, then they watch for problems or complications during pregnancy. They say that gestational diabetes can increase your risk of type 2 later in life, but it's certainly not a guarantee that you're going to develop the disorder. If you're interested in taking a risk test for diabetes, the website diabetes.org will let you run through a quiz and tell you if you're at a higher risk for forming type 2 diabetes. And so these are some of the risk factors here for forming diabetes. All right, that takes you down to the bottom of page 15. How about questions on the pancreas? Stuff making sense so far? I'm going to leave for you the top of page 16 to read over. The pineal gland and the thymus gland, they're a very short read, so you may want to put a note there to yourself to be sure and read through those two. Pages 17 through 19 are practice pages, and the answers to those are on D2L in the announcements. If you guys will just go to the news in our D2L course and scroll down, those answers are listed at the bottom of those announcements. Looks like we're ready to start blood, and I'm going to work this next chapter in reverse. I thought I would hit blood typing first, and then we'll go backwards, and we'll go back to the beginning of the chapter on Monday. But I'd like to just make sure that you have enough opportunity to practice and work on blood typing. So since we're working in reverse, let me take you over to page 29. So some really awesome websites exist out there to help you with blood typing. The Nobel Prize website, I mentioned that one earlier, that's a really fantastic place to practice. And they will keep throwing out patients at you until you feel like you've mastered it. Basically what they ask you to do is blood type the patient and then turn around and give them bags of compatible blood. And so it really can hone your skills and make you comfortable with the topic. if you find that you've gone through that until you're just like, all right, I'm done with this, then try the Red Cross website. They've also got a game that you can play on there. Red Cross also has an explanation for blood typing, so that may be worth a read if you're finding that you're getting stuck in terms of getting the antigens and antibodies straight. GetBodySmart.com also has a tutorial exactly like what you do in lab, you know, where you do the antigens and antibodies in that little stopper kit. So that can also be a great place to practice the lab material. So when you're thinking about what you're doing in lab versus lecture, we're teaching you the same thing. It's that we're coming at it from two different perspectives. So that you don't necessarily think of it as two different processes. It's all part of the same process of understanding blood typing. All right, so how comfortable are you with blood typing at this point? Let's say on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 is a very comfortable person, 1 is not, 6, 5 or 6. So you have a grasp, but you don't really feel totally comfortable yet? Okay. So instead of explaining these two terms with blood typing, let's talk about the flu because that's everywhere right now, right? Okay, so they've been advertising that flu shot like crazy, right? Okay, so if you get the flu shot, they're saying that you should have it 2 weeks prior to exposure, like you can control that, right? Okay, but nonetheless, if you had the flu shot far enough in advance, 2 weeks ahead of time, they're giving you a broken down flu virus in the hopes that your body will build these Y-shaped antibodies to fight against that flu virus. Okay, so what they're doing is they're stimulating your immune system to make antibodies against the flu virus. And hopefully, if you're actually exposed to the virus, the real one that's in circulation, these antibodies will attack and clump up and get rid of that flu virus for you. So that's the goal there of having a vaccine like the flu vaccine. Why do you have it every year? Because they think a different virus circulates every year. So, you know, 1 year, this antibody may work, but you may also need another population of antibodies for the other form of the flu virus that circulates next year and so forth. So what we're talking about is white blood cells making antibodies. These antibodies will attack foreign things that come in contact with your body. Okay, flu virus, you know, foreign things like bacteria, even other people's red blood cells can be considered foreign, and our body will make these antibodies to attack and get rid of them. So in terms of antigens, these are the things that our body uses to recognize us. There are certain types of white blood cells that will circulate constantly. I have this mental picture. Do you have a dog that lives in your neighborhood that comes by your property all the time? Okay. Does that dog sniff and lift his leg and pee and keep on going? You see that dog often? That dog comes by and smells to make sure he's been there before if he has any pees? Okay. That's what your white blood cells do. Your white blood cells check you out all the time. And they don't lift their leg and pee on you, thank goodness. But what they do is they say, you smell like me, you're good to go, you can stay here. And then if they find something that doesn't smell like them, they say, oh, I'm going to get rid of you. I'm going to make one of these antibodies to fight against and get rid of that foreign object. Okay? So, you know, our white blood cells are kind of like dogs checking out the neighborhood. They've got to make sure everybody belongs, and anything that doesn't, they fight and get rid of. These are called antigens. And so if they are your own self-antigens, you know, we sniff and smell and make sure they're our own, those self-antigens we have no need to get rid of, okay? But if it's somebody else's antigens, like somebody else's blood cells, then our white blood cells say, hey, you don't look like us. We should get rid of you, right? And so they make these antibodies to fight those foreign antigens. So I want to clarify here. There's two kinds of antigens. There's ones that you have that are considered your own and yourself, and those are the ones we don't bother. We don't mess with your own, okay? But the ones that we are going to fight and get rid of are the antigens that we don't recognize as our own. Those are considered foreign antigens. And like I mentioned, you know, flu virus, bacteria, other people's cells are all considered to be foreign, and then we are going to fight and get rid of those using these Y-shaped antibodies. okay? So antigens are things that are considered either self or foreign, and antibodies are these Y-shaped things that attack and get rid of those foreign antigens. Anybody need this screen? So I want to show you the picture of the outside of our cells. You may have seen this before in Bio-210. We know the outside surface of our cells has a lot of stuff going on out there, and some of these surface features can be thought of as antigens. So when you're thinking about a red blood cell, think about it in terms of this. These surface features are checked out by our white blood cells. If they look like us, the white blood cells leave them alone. They keep on trucking. If we don't recognize these external surface features, then what happens?
They go right ahead and destroy it.
Destroy it, exactly. So these Y-shaped antibodies are built very specifically. Let me show you how they work.
Or like a key.
Like a key, right. So if you've got an antigen with one shape, that antibody builds to that shape. So it's like having tools in a toolkit, right? You've got certain kinds of screwdrivers, certain kinds of wrenches. You've got antibodies built the very same way. They're built very specifically for the antigens that they work on. Okay, so this antibody work on two different things. Okay, so they're shaped different. They've got different binding sites. So yeah, they're like a lock and a key. They're not going to necessarily be able to work on just anything that comes along that's considered foreign. So let's say that you're given a transfusion of blood types that are not compatible. This is what may happen. These are red blood cells, and these surface features here are what we consider to be our antigens. If these antigens are considered foreign, these Y-shaped antibodies will bind them, and the binding process is called agglutination. This is an antibody-antigen reaction. You may have heard it called a transfusion reaction before. And so this cross-linking that you see happening here creates a mighty big clump. What do you think that does to your body?
It's going to rupture those red blood cells and make them spread into your kidneys.
Exactly. Rupture those red blood cells. And of course, they can travel to your kidneys and they can cause problems there. So you're exactly right. You've got these clumped up messes of red blood cells that now can rip up your capillaries, damage your kidneys. So that's why we want to be sure to avoid transfusion reactions and this clumping process that's specifically called agglutination. Okay? So far, so good. Do I need to go back anywhere? Okay. So what are these surface features on the red blood cells called?
Antigens.
Antigens, good. And what are these Y-shaped structures called?
Antibodies.
Antibodies, good. Can antibodies work on just any old antigen?
No, have to be a specific key.
Got to be a specific one, right. And do you need antibodies built against your own?
No.
No, because yourself is okay.
It's recognizable.
Yeah, recognizable, right. Don't fight the cell, fight the foreign stuff, right? Okay. Think we're ready to go to the middle of your page. This is middle of 29. All right, so there's a lot of different blood typing groups. We're going to talk about the most common ones. I'm sure you've heard of the ABO blood groups before. That is probably one of the most recognizable blood groups. So let's talk about how it's set up. It's based on the presence of antigens on the surface of a red blood cell. The two antigens are antigen A and antigen B. Okay, so that first line there, middle of page 29, the ABO blood groups are based on two antigens. They are antigen A and antigen B. So we have four options. You may not be able to see the letters on my little flashcards here, but the color should be helpful. This is antigen A on here, so that's all I got. And on here, I've got a yellow dot. This one's antigen B. And I could even have both antigens. I could have antigens A and B, or I could have neither one. I could just have O. Good, good. So we've got four options. If you have no antigens, then your blood type is O. And that's your next blank. Okay. If you have no antigens, your blood type is O. About 40% of the population is type O.
How was it that blood that O could be given to anybody without the body, without the other body destroying it?
In terms of blood cells, there's nothing on here that's recognizable. It's kind of like the ghost format you can sneak in. And if your blood type is, say, A, you look at that and your white blood cells sniff it and they say, you know, there's nothing wrong with that blood cell. In fact, there's nothing recognizable about it at all. So it can come into your bloodstream and actually cause, cell-wise, no immune response. Yeah, because there's nothing on there to set off an alarm. Let's see, if you have both antigens A and B, your blood type is what?
AB.
Good. If you have the A antigen, your blood type is A. Good. And if you have the B antigen, your blood type is
B.
So I know that there's a lot of A's, B's, and ABs and O's and stuff going on here. Let me just emphasize that if you're thinking about blood types, it is face value. What you see is what you get. If you say that I have an antigen for A, that's in my blood type, right? I've got at least A as my blood type. If I say my antigen is B, that's my blood type. If I have both antigens, A and B, that's my blood type. And the catch, of course, is there are no antigens for O. O has neither antigen A nor B. The next two questions there talk about the universal donor and universal recipient. Let's talk about the universal donor. It is type... Good, it's O. And if you want to be specific, is it O negative or positive?
O
positive.
Negative. Yep, it's O negative. And the universal recipient?
AB.
AB, good. And if you want to be specific, it's AB positive. That's right. Let's talk about transfusions for just a moment. When somebody gets a transfusion, the transfusion may only require blood cells. Okay? And if we're talking about blood cells, then antigens are our concern, right? Because we've got to look and say, hey, are you compatible with me? Are you giving me something foreign that I've never seen before? So if blood cells are involved in the transfusion, then I've got to be concerned about the antigens. Now, sometimes they give a whole blood donation, and at that point, I now also have to be concerned about possible antibodies. So let's take O for instance. By the time everybody is around 5 years old, just living in the earth and eating foods, you're going to be exposed to any antigens that you don't currently have of the ABO blood group. So if you are blood type O, by the time you're age 5, you've already formed a small army of antibodies against which antigens?
A and B.
A and B, exactly. So if you're type O, circulating in your blood plasma, that's the watery part of your blood, you're going to have anti-A and anti-B antibodies. Okay? So here's the catch. If I donate to you O blood cells, are there any antigens here to cause your problems?
No.
Okay, so antigen-wise, we're good to go. That's why they call it the universal donor. If I give you whole blood, though, you not only get my harmless cells, but you also get these antibodies, right? So you get the anti-A and the anti-B antibodies if you get the whole blood donation. If you're giving this to blood type A, you know, I'm giving you an anti-A antibody, right?
You kill the person doing that.
It could cause some agglutination, right? Okay, it's a small risk, but what's important is you're getting probably enough blood cells to keep your oxygen levels up and keep you alive. So do they do it?
Yeah.
Okay, so they do the transfusion. This is a small risk. You know, it's not necessarily something that's going to cause harm, but they do, you know, they're cognizant of the fact that they may be getting those antibodies with the blood plasma. Let's do another case scenario. Let's say that you've got a burn patient. Burn patients may not need your red blood cells. They may simply need your blood plasma. So if we're using O negative blood plasma, what are you getting from that person?
They're anti-A and anti-B.
Yeah, they're getting the anti-A and anti-B antibodies. So something else just to be aware of if we're getting whole blood versus plasma versus just blood cells, okay? So if it's blood cells, your concern is antigens. Okay, I'll jot this down on the board for you. So if you're getting just blood cells in a transfusion, it's the antigens to be concerned about. If you're getting just the liquid part of the blood called the blood plasma, then antibodies are what we look for. And if you're getting what's called a whole blood transfusion, that's blood cells and antibodies, or sorry, blood cells and plasma, then yeah, it's antigens and antibodies we're going to look at. I'm going to put a star here beside antigens because that's the biggest concern. You know, that's the one that can cause the agglutination. The antibodies you receive from a transfusion are less likely to cause major problems. What's really going to cause the issues is getting the antigens into your body and your own antibodies then turning around and trying to fight those foreigners. Just a couple of minutes left. Let me take you on over to page 30 and introduce Rh factor. Let's talk about the flu again. So if people are feeling sick and they go to the doctor's office and they get tested or swabbed for the flu virus, if they come back and say you've got the flu, then you are positive for the flu, right? And if you're lucky, they'll come back and say, nope, you're negative. Meaning what?
You don't have it.
You don't have it, right. So in terms of the Rh factor, this is a different blood typing group than the ABO blood group. And actually most of us carry the Rh factor. About 85% of us have this particular antigen on our blood cells. If you have the Rh factor, we can say you are positive for the Rh factor. We may simply say you have the Rh antigen, or we may say you have the Rh factor. So either of those things is going to be the same language for saying that you carry that particular antigen on your blood cells. Now, if we say that you're negative for the Rh factor, it doesn't mean you have something. It means you just don't have it at all, right? So if you're negative, that means you do not carry an antigen for the Rh factor. About 15% of our population carries no Rh antigen. So the catch is, if you're positive, can I give you negative blood? Okay, so if you're not sure, look at the negative blood cell. Is there anything here that might be considered foreign? Nah. Yeah, so we're not introducing anything that's foreign to that positive person, okay? So positive people can get positive blood and they can get negative blood. It's best to be positive, right? Because you can open up your opportunities for blood transfusions. Now, let's switch the tables. Let's say that you are negative, one of those 15% of the population. You can get negative blood, okay? But if I introduce this positive Rh factor, can you receive it? Yeah, I'm introducing something foreign to you. Your body will form anti-Rh antibodies against that Rh factor. An interesting thing is, unlike the ABO blood group, you have not formed antibodies by the time you're age 5. It takes a transfusion or pregnancy to expose you to the Rh factor if you're negative, and gives you time to form those anti-Rh antibodies. So the first transfusion is actually not a strong reaction, but the second transfusion would be. What is built up between the first and the second transfusions?
Antibodies.
Yeah, you're right, antibodies. So unfortunately, if they don't do something like give you a corticosteroid to suppress antibody formation, you will then have an army of these anti-Rh antibodies to attack and agglutinate that foreign blood type. All right. So what I'd like to do is cut you guys loose for the weekend with page 31. If you would work on that page, see how far you can get. You may want to print a clean copy you can mess with. We'll do it together in here on Monday. Okay? Y'all have a good weekend.